So this is
okay.
Job, and Job and I talked before. So go ahead, Job.
Yeah. So Paul, you were saying about all the atheists you keep in the church dungeon. What was that?
That's right. That's
yeah.
Right. So what I like is that Jordan Peterson was living in his son's basement, and I just imagined his son having to rescue him from the underground. That's what I've been thinking about since the January Q&A.
Oh, I didn't see that one. That's the first time I hear it, but that's interesting.
Yeah, well, Peterson had a bunch of interviews, and he's in this weird place, and it's like, it's not a hotel room, it's not his office. Where is he? And then the Q&A, he mentioned that he's having some remodeling done at his home, so he's in his son's garage, and the cat was rolling something upstairs on the floor, and it was bothering him. And so I thought, yeah, his son has to rescue him from the underground. And I just thought that was too much fun. So Job, we talked before, but what do you want to talk about today?
Now, first off, I'm going to ask you a question, and I'm doing that for the good of other people who watch these videos. I and other people need to know what the baptism book is about, and we can't see it anymore. So there's this green baptism book you have. Yeah, it's in your bookcase to the right of you. It's behind that white book. It says baptism. There we go. See, I've been wondering about that forever.
Baptism in the New Testament. It's by an author, G.R. Beasley Murray. He was a New Testament scholar. He was a Baptist, and so he didn't believe in infant baptism, but this is a really nice study of baptism in the New Testament. And goes through basically the background of baptism, what it's about. I read this, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 years ago. Antecedents of Christian baptism, foundations of Christian baptism, emergence of Christian baptism, the Acts of the Apostles, development of Christian baptism, and the apostolic witness. This is just all New Testament theology stuff.
Sounds like a lot more to baptism than I knew about. Yeah. But now I have closure. Now I know. I needed to know. I've always been kind of like, oh, that book. And then you had put a book in front of it. Like, no,
well, I need. I'm a slob. My office is not in order. Now, this is a book of, I want to talk to, I recorded a conversation with an Orthodox priest who actually was in a CRC for a while with this man, Len Vanderzee, who's a friend of mine. So I'm going to do a conversation with Len because he wrote this book, which really kind of opened my eyes to sacramentalism, recovering the sacraments for evangelical worship, Christ, baptism, and the Lord's Supper. And so Len was out here in Sacramento. He was covering for another pastor friend of mine in one of our church plants, but he's a really good guy, and he wrote this book. So I mentioned this book, and I just threw it up here, and so that's why I covered the baptism book. So
it would be an interesting sub-series, like Paul's Bookshelf, and then you discuss what you learned from that book. Because you have loads of them here, and I bet they're like this Ecclesiastes and the Ephesians and.
Well, this is a
I don't want to give you ideas from. I know, all these videos, I can't wait.
So this is a fun one. Heaven is a Place on Earth. This is by someone who's in Grand Rapids, I think. Why Everything You Do Matters to God. This is more of books have all these different levels. Baptism, that's an academic book. This is much more of anybody can read this book. I'd call that middle brow. G.K. Beale is a very interesting guy. He's conservative, reformed, and he does a lot of biblical theology. We Become What We Worship, great title, and goes through. I've got a number of books by G.K. Beale. I really like him as a scholar.
I'm telling you, man, you got a series on your hands here.
So we
got Words at Fudge, Paul's books. I'm just selfish, and I like what you're doing. It was actually at some point. So since we first talked, it became such a thing that when I would play one of your videos, that like Mallory would say, "Oh yeah, we haven't heard Paul in a while." Like you became such a voice in our house, and we both watched all your videos and your sermons, and then we discussed the videos. Like, oh yeah, we should discuss this with Paul, and then we forget because there's all this stuff we want to discuss. So I figure I would call this video Reese's Pieces to Jesus. And because Mallory said that I should watch E.T. And I don't want to watch E.T. I don't think it's a very interesting movie. But apparently there's Reese's Pieces and they're being lured to get E.T. somewhere. Fine. But I would watch these videos and then I'd like, this doesn't make sense to me. And I'd try to discuss with Mallory and Paul's saying these things. And then like, okay, morality, And this philosophy, And then this and this, and suddenly Jesus and glory. And like, whoa. You can't just suddenly throw Jesus up here. Like, I'm not ready for that stuff. So, like, right, I can't get there. And then, you know, Esther O'Reilly is, of course, like, I front load Jesus wherever. You can't escape Jesus. Like, okay, that's kind of a different approach. Okay, I'll stay right here. And no, I like Esther. We've had some DM messages, and I like, she's really, she doesn't bullshit.
That's no, she doesn't. No. And she won't say the word either.
And I, I mean, I follow her on Twitter, and it's also because on a lot of things, I don't agree with her, but I like seeing that, okay, why don't I agree? Maybe she has a point. It's kind of rule 9 applied. You know, like maybe she doesn't know something. Maybe I haven't thought about this well enough.
Esther is super smart. See, so I know a little bit, you know, Esther is super smart. She's very evangelical. She's quite young too. So she, you know, she's still very much in progress, but she's working up her hierarchy and she's a good writer and she's a polymath in a lot of ways. She's a very interesting person. So,
yeah,
but she,
definitely.
But she strikes some people. I mean, Julian's had a lot of interesting, you know, back and forth with her too. And, it's fun.
Yeah, and she'll say, like, you know, evolution, I see a designer at work, and you know, my 30-year-old atheism is like, there is no designer at work, look at these, you know, clearly, it says, like, wait a second, I'm just as convinced of, fine, I like kind of being in this space of not knowing. That's why I am. I mean, you told me to read C.S. Lewis. See, C.S. Lewis pisses me off, and I'm going to tell you why. Oh, yeah. Because
I want to hear about this.
Oh, right. So I started out with Surprised by Joy.
Yeah.
I listened to the entire, I'm sorry, Pastor. I listened to the entire damn thing. And suddenly he's like, oh, and then I realized Jesus was Lord. What? You can't just suddenly. How did you get there? And he doesn't explain. He whines about his childhood in his terrible baggy trousers boarding school, and then suddenly Jesus because of a conversation he had with Tolkien. Like, how does that work? You need to explain that. So, fine. Maybe he'll explain it in Mere Christianity. So I start listening to Mere Christianity, and he starts out with the moral law, and like, and then what he does a lot is he'll say something, and then I'll go in my head, aha, but you didn't think about X and Y, and then he'll continue. For those of you who thought I forget about X and Y, actually it's this. Damn it, Lewis, stop laying these traps, because I walk right into it. So, oh, man, yeah, that Mere Christianity is interesting, because he gets these ideas, and like, I hadn't considered this. Like, it doesn't convince me, but it allows me to think about it in different contexts. So then for Mere Christianity, I went to, what's the one about men without chests? Abolition of Man.
Abolition of
Very
Man.
Good. Chapter 3 was like,
Yeah.
Chapter 3 was interesting because I'm into robotics and AI, and it's just like, yeah, when do we? Oh, man. What was another book? The one about hell.
Oh, The Great Divorce.
The Great Divorce. That one was. And Mallory and I, we just listen. We go to sign language class and we drive there and then we listen to Lewis and then we discuss it. And we're both going, like, Lewis says something about, we're going through miracles, and Lewis will have said something like, obviously, you know, something about reason. And then we both go, poof, and then he goes on to, well, actually, it's logically defensible like this. And we're like, stop doing that, Lewis. You're poking at my axioms. No, I mean, I like kind of being sarcastic about this stuff, but the guy has such a way with words. It's,
yeah.
I don't agree with him, but he's an amazing writer.
Yeah.
And
he's a brilliant guy.
So we're not done with Miracles yet, but The Great Divorce was just really interesting from a storytelling point of view. And of course, your recent video where you expanded on some of the doodles, the Lewis doodles, was very interesting in that regard. Because like, oh yeah, I forgot that I went through that book. And it's
the crazy thing about Lewis is that you can, with some people and some authors, if you reread them, there's no point to it. You read them once and you're done. With Lewis, you can keep rereading him because you keep learning more every time you go through it. I've probably gone through Miracles 5 or 6 times, and every time I go through it, it's like another layer comes off. And not a lot of authors are like that, but Lewis is. Tolkien's like that too. Every time I go through The Lord of the Rings, let me rephrase that. Fiction can be more like that often than just prose, nonfiction essays, which is what Lewis does. Because an essay is usually just kind of, it's out here in front. And fiction, because it's a story and because it's a representation, always has layers. And because when we look at that representation, we're bringing things to that representation too. So there's a very dynamic interplay between us and fiction that there isn't necessarily between us and prose. But Lewis's prose and essays, they keep going deeper. He's a really complex guy.
He's clearly thought to a depth about this that, I don't know, man, my 13-year-old atheism is getting walloped, but it's just...
Yeah, well, that's how he grew up, walloping his 13-year-old atheist. That's what you're reading.
And
you probably look at a biography of Lewis's, because the biographies open up a lot more. And my favorite biography of Lewis is Alan Jacobs, The Narnian. It's not the most recent, but that's my favorite biography of Lewis, because and there's an abridged audiobook of that. But my favorite biography of Lewis is The Narnian, because he goes into Mento. So Mento was Lewis's. So Lewis went to World War I. Lewis's childhood was a disaster because his mother died and his father was cold and didn't know how to raise him and sent him to these horrible boarding schools. And you get that in Surprised by Joy. What you don't get in Surprised by Joy is the adult Lewis, because Lewis doesn't talk about that, because Lewis doesn't want to talk about that. So basically, Lewis goes to World War I. And Lewis was never an athlete. He was not a jock at all. He was missing a joint in his thumb, which is just really weird. But he goes into World War I, and he makes a pact with one of his buddies that if I die, you take care of my family, and if you die, I take care of your family. So he goes into World War I, and his buddy dies. And Lewis gets injured, and then he basically waits out the rest of the war in a hospital, so the war doesn't kill him. But then this guy had a divorced mother and a sister. And Lewis doesn't talk about this, but I think the evidence is plainly clear. Lewis isn't a Christian at this time. He basically starts a sexual affair with the guy's mother that goes on for a long time. And so he and the guy's mother basically live together. And Lewis was also into there's some evidence Lewis was into like kinky sex. And so sadomasochism and this kind of stuff. I know. Who'd have thought? St. Lewis. But so read The Narnian. So there's all these layers of, you know, but he's living a double life. On one hand, he's living with this woman. On the other hand, he's an Oxford Don. And he's trying to make his way as a career. He's trying to be a poet, but he's not a very good poet. And that isn't really going. And then he strikes up this relationship with Tolkien and Dyson and Barfield and eventually Charles Williams. I mean, all these people via Oxford, and he becomes a Christian. well, what's he going to do with this relationship with this woman? Now, this woman's old enough to be his mother, so there's some psychological things in there. Another really good book, if I have it here, a really good book by a Harvard professor that compares Lewis and Freud. If you want, I can look up the title for that.
Lewis and Freud.
That's a really interesting book. So a Harvard psychology professor basically held a course where he compared C.S. Lewis with Sigmund Freud. Let me pull up the. That's let's see, where is it? Here it is. I'll share the screen so you can see it. I'll pull up the cover. Okay, it's okay. Share screen. Okay, the question of God, by Armand Nicolai.
How about a title, huh?
yeah. C.S. Lewis and Sigmund Freud debate God, love, sex, and the meaning of life. Toronto Press. So this guy taught at Harvard, and he did a whole course, which became a very popular course, in comparing Freud and Lewis, and it's a really interesting comparison. So basically Lewis has a relationship with this woman that's his mother's age, and it's been a sexual relationship, and they've kind of raised this guy's younger sister, and so she's kind of like a daughter to Lewis, and now Lewis becomes a Christian. Well, what should he do? Well, he continued, he took care of this woman until she died, and Lewis's brother was furious at him for this. Lewis's colleagues couldn't figure out what the heck it is, because this woman became old and she had dementia and she was fast. And so Lewis would have to clean up after her little dogs that kept shitting in the house. And I mean, it was just this disaster. And you get the impression that Lewis is living in hell, taking care of this woman. And everyone's like, why are you taking care of this woman? Well, on one hand, he had a cover story that, well, this was, he had a promise, so okay, but really, yeah, just send her some money. But no, he takes care of her. And, you know, Lewis has some of his own twistedness too. Another recent book that I read, the woman who would become Lewis's wife, Joy Davidman. I talked about that in some videos a little bit. I'll pull the cover of, let's see if they can have the cover of that. Yeah, so I'll share the screen. Hang on. This one. Joy, poet seeker, the woman who captivated C.S. Lewis. I really like this biography because it wasn't hagiography. A lot of times with Lewis, so many people have become Christians because of Lewis. Once they become Christians through him, they honor him as a saint, and then they want to treat his wife as a saint. This woman was no saint. This was a fascinating book. This woman was a Marxist. She was an atheist. She, even after her conversion, she got into Scientology. She was petty. She was brilliant. This is a fascinating biography, and you really get a very interesting picture of Lewis through this book, because this woman herself had a very interesting life. She was a mess, but very interesting life. And she basically stalked C.S. Lewis and captured him. It's like the question, what if a stalker wins? That's the story. I mean, it's just crazy, this stuff. So there's so much out there.
Makes you want to read it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's wild stuff. I mean, life, true life, is so much more crazy than we think. And the thing is, what we do to each other is we all mask the craziness. We mask the sins. See, that's part of the nice thing about talking to people who aren't Christian, because non-Christians won't mask their sin as much. Well, now that society's getting all moral, they're playing other games. But that they won't mask the sins that within a Christian community would have you lose status, okay? But real life is really crazy. And when people actually let you in to see what, and this is what being a pastor is like, because people will come and tell pastors what they won't tell their wives because they can't. And that's, you need people to, you know, that's why we have therapists. Therapists are basically in some ways modern versions of pastors.
I guess, but they have a different air.
Yeah. Because when you go to a therapist, they're working, they're giving you Freud or something else. You go to a pastor, he's trying to give you God. But God is a lot weirder.
See, that's something, yeah. I mean, God is a lot weirder. Tell me about it. I can't get a word in without all your laughter. No, it's fine.
I'll laugh silently.
I'm just joking.
You laugh on the inside.
Laughing is healthy, they say. I've been basically, since all the Harris and your videos and Peterson stuff, have just kind of been trying to find morality bedrock. Now, Hyde has interesting ideas about it. It turns out David Hume had interesting ideas about it. Of course, the Greeks had and everything. But I was running at some point. I went for a run and I was kind of thinking about this and like, okay, so why are you running? Kind of let's do this Socrates. Why am I running? Well, I need to be in shape. Okay, so why do I need to be in shape? Why do anything, you know? If nothing matters, why do anything? Here I am out for a run. Isn't it even nice weather? So I'm running. Why? I need to be in shape. Why? Well, because what if there's a fire? Okay, what if there's a fire? Well, I might need to help people. Well, why do you need to help people? Well, because you're a firefighter. Okay, why are you a firefighter? Well, because someone needs to be. And I wanted to do something for the village that I went into. So, okay, so you wanted to do something for the village. Why? I don't know. I wanted to get to meet people. Why? Okay, so you get into this hole of why do anything? Well, because I think being responsible in case there's a fire is a good thing. Okay, so this is idea of good. Now we're getting somewhere. So you're running because in the end it's all to get to some high thing. Peugeot would have a field day with this sort of stuff. And I'm like, okay, so I work in digital accessibility, which means that I try to make sure that websites and tools are available for people with disabilities. Well, why? Well, I might have a disability someday. It's not the same thing. I've seen people use shitty apps, you know, and I've seen how frustrating it is, and I know how easy it is to make stuff accessible if you know how to do it. Okay, but I don't know. I could do anything. Why that? Okay, because it's a good thing to make something work for something else. Cool. So, okay. I have some, all that tells me is that I have some sort of source of conscience or morality, wherever that is. Where does that come from? I don't know. Lewis has interesting ideas about where reason comes from. At this point, I don't know anything. I've only come to the conclusion that I don't know anything, which is a good start, but there's too much out there. I don't have I don't have a very high education. I mean, I do IT, but I taught myself. I didn't study philosophy or anything like that. So I was trying to find out what humanism had to say about morality. And I found this interesting thread on Reddit where somebody basically asked that sort of question. I'll send you the link later. It says, what is the foundation for morals and atheism? Because I was trying to figure that out. Like, clearly I'm an atheist. So where do my morals come from? And what is Peterson's position refuting it? And they basically go in, okay, how do we get to morals here? And somebody says, careful there. And they deleted their account because sucks. I don't know who wrote it. Careful there. If you abandon immature religion in favor of atheism and then you start looking for a foundation of morality, you might wind up in mature religion. I'm like, boom. Like, oh, so that's what this is. And they say, they say a lot of stuff, but they say all systems of morality have something in it for you. As a child in traditional religion, you learn that if you're good, you go to heaven, and if you're bad, you go to hell. Good and bad can be defined differently depending on the religion, from obeying all the rules to accepting Jesus, and from behaving badly to lacking faith in Jesus. But in every case, there's a way you ought to behave and a way you ought not to behave. And then they go into, well, you know, at some point, your 13-year-old atheism is just going to be not enough. You're going to, if you want to properly investigate why you hold certain ideas, then that's not going to be enough, because it doesn't say anything about that. It only says, well, there's likely not a God. It doesn't say anything else. So it's a whole thing. I'll send you the link. You'll like reading it. And I'm reading that and like, oh no, this is just only getting worse. Right. But I'm just going to watch Hitchens. And I did find Bart Ehrman, who I didn't know. And his ideas are interesting, because he basically says, so Jesus existed, pretty obviously that he existed, but he was an apocalyptic prophet, got nailed to a cross for being a seditionist. And, well, they made something up, because clearly, I mean, it must have been part of the plan if he got crucified. And, you know, my rational part of the mind goes, yep, that makes sense. Yep. And then N.T. Wright goes, they wouldn't make that up. That wasn't part of their culture. Fuck. I'm still in the, I don't know anything at this point. It could be, God could exist, whatever. But the whole Jesus thing, I can't get there, man. It's just, it's too far away. It's just, I can approach it psychologically, like Jesus and the city of God, climb the hill, carry responsibility, carry that cross, bucko, and do the thing, fight the fire. Because somebody needs to, and those people aren't going to do it, but you can do it. But the fact that, like, Jesus was the Son of God and he died for my sins, or whatever that means, that's too much, because that's original sin, and that conflicts way too much with some core ideas I hold about punishing people eternally for finite sin and all that sort of human morality. And God goes, and I know he does, but so. I don't know. It's Ehrman makes good points. But then I say, hey, Esther, what do you think of Ehrman? And she's like, oh, okay. So maybe Ehrman's wrong. And then N.T. Wright's just making really good points about the resurrection. Like, well, what if I'm wrong about any of this? And my mind is like, since when are we doubting that any of this was not just made up? Like, I'm not. Okay, so here's a note I made in my notes to discuss with Paul. Paul, none of this was supposed to happen.
You see,
I was supposed to be an atheist, nihilist, and try to live a life and eventually die without suffering, or at least as little suffering as I could manage. And then why would I be a firefighter? Because that's pretty risky. But fine, whatever. I didn't expect to really get past 30 anyway, because what's the point of anything? And now it's just like, well, I can do anything. And there's all these books I can read. And there's no negative voice in my head for like almost 3/4 of a year now. And I can just think without being distracted by intrusive thoughts. And like, well, wait, this life is really nice. I'd like way more of this. Wait, can I keep this for like another 40 years, please? Because this is just amazing. And yeah, I don't know, man. It's just all I get is more questions. And I've been going to church for maybe since November. And so that was interesting, because I go to church and first you kind of hope that nobody recognizes you. Feels like a fucking fraud, man. I'm sorry for all the swearing. There needs to be a warning on this video, because I'm just speaking from the heart at this point. So first time we go to church and like, all right, this seems okay. Nobody's looking at me funny. I'm not combusting. I'm good. And they go the second week and like, well, week 2, I'm still not being suspected. All right. But then people start noticing you, like, hey, we've seen you around. Do you like the church? I'm like, well, I don't know. And I don't know. We have a really good new pastor, and he gives really good sermons, kind of your style. Not as emotive, because that's the Dutch don't do that. But there's jokes and there's psychology and a bit of poking, and that's good. But no, look, I eventually asked myself this question. I said, Job, you're a fucking hypocrite. Would you go to a Buddhist Zen temple if there was one down the street? Well, yeah, that's cool. Okay, would you go to some other like self-improvement group where you could have discussions about philosophy? Yeah. Would you go to Jordan Peterson meetup group? Sure, I would. So, yeah, but they want to give me bread and wine in there, and it's weird. And that's childhood. And I wouldn't do that after I was 18 because I didn't have to. I mean, I'm assuming it's connected somehow, you know? And the people have been nothing but nice. And, you know, we like that you're here. And, you know, it's, the congregation is fairly old, so they like to see a young person. But I don't know. And people have been asking my wife and I, like, you know, would you like to come have dinner with us? No strings attached, no pressure. Would you like to become members of the church? No pressure. They're being very nice about it. And to me, it's like, I was talking to Mallory about it. It's like, this is becoming really dangerous. What if there's no way back, you know? Like, what if I can't escape this anymore? What if I'm being pulled too far in? Like, I can still see my nice, safe atheism over there. That's really nice. Like, that's my truths, and I know how the world works. And now that I have, you know, no longer that nihilistic outlook, maybe I can combine that into some form of nice Pinker-esque humanism. But this is also really nice. And then, you know, buddy from the fire department says, why don't you come to Bible club? I'm like, Bible club? Yeah, we discuss parts of the Bible in depth. Oh, that sounds interesting. So then we're talking about the Sermon on the Mount. And then people are like, well, these atheists, they don't believe in nothing. And I was like, excuse me, that's not true. And they were like, there's an atheist in the room. Like, well, sort of. I don't know at this point. So, I don't know, Paul. It's just been weird. It's been really weird. It's been Reese's Pieces, and it's just Reese's Pieces to weirdness more. So I was going to ask you, and I'm going to be rude about it. I'm just going to be really direct about it.
You wouldn't be Dutch if you wouldn't.
What's God to you? Or who? Or how does that work?
You want me to put this into words? That's
a hard thing.
I've had a whole bunch of conversations this week that I'm going to post, but I try not to post more than once a day, so they're going to trickle out. And it's so hard to talk about because you can say, well, God is everything, but that's not quite right because he isn't everything, because there's a lot of stuff that isn't God because it isn't good, but he's the sum of all joys. I'm hoping to talk to James Lindsay, who is one of the hoax paper writers, because in his talk with Peterson, you know, he noted that he got into this because he was working on the question. He lives in the Bible Belt in the United States, and he was working on the question of what, when people say God, what do they mean? And I love that question because it's a great question. So I was also listening, and I was thinking about, I haven't had time to make videos this week, so I've just been posting conversations because I have those in the can. So Sitch and Adam from Think Club, from the Think Club channel, they did a live stream talking about Owen Benjamin. And oh shoot, where was I going with this? So Owen Benjamin is just freaking out, and he's just hates Jordan Peterson now because he used to love him. He's just spurned. And so Owen Benjamin's just all upset that Jordan Peterson won't say, I believe God exists. And he's all upset by that. But I understand exactly why Peterson gives the answer he's giving. And when I say I understand why, it's not that I can, well, necessarily be able to articulate that to everyone's satisfaction, but I know how Peterson feels and why he says it, because if you see enough, if you have a deep enough understanding of, I'm going to say, of who God is more than what God is, because in a sense, between human beings, when we say what God is instead of who God is, we actually demote God. But if you have a sense of who God is, believe is too thin a word. Of course I believe, but it's more that, I mean, because you were talking a little bit ago and, you know, you can't get to Jesus. Well, here's the crazy thing. you don't get to go to Jesus. He comes to you. This is C.S. Lewis. This is C.S. Lewis on pantheism. Pantheism, the problem with pantheism is God is out there. And, you know, you've been into the looking glass and you've been going down the rabbit hole. And you think, well, I could stop this anytime I want. But the truth is you can't. You came here honestly, of your own volition, sort of.
Yeah, I'm starting to realize that. It's frightening, man.
Yeah, it should be frightening. Yeah,
this wasn't supposed to happen, Paul.
No, it wasn't supposed to be over there. You thought.
Right.
And so that immature Christian to atheism to mature religion, you know, yeah, there's really something to that. Because this was Lewis's thing. And this was Joy David.
A coworker of mine is Eastern Orthodox or Ukrainian Orthodox. Lots of like ritual in there. It's amazing. Like Protestant seems kind of boring. we were having a discussion and I said, well, you know, we're talking about what does he believe? What do I believe? And I said, well, maybe I'm a Christian agnostic. Does that work? Like, because I seem to behave from a certain way, and maybe, I don't know, I can't prove anything at this point, so who knows? So you're saying God to you is ineffable?
Ineffable is too distant. I can't articulate.
Too large?
Too large, yes. When you walk into, you haven't been to the Grand Canyon in the United States, have you?
No, it's too high up. I need to be below sea level, man. I can't breathe up there.
You can go down. But the thing is, when you go to the Grand Canyon or Yosemite or one of these places like this, you can't get your mind around it because it's too large. And you realize how you can have the same effect by going away from city lights and looking up into the sky at the stars. And you realize how tiny you are. And this David in the Psalms articulates this. He says, you know, he says to God, what is man? What are human beings that you should think about us? Because when we get out there in nature, even we begin to realize, oh man, we're small and life is strange. And when you're going along thinking you're in control, you're just naive.
Hmm. Man, it's just, I was telling Mallory, like, this, none of this is like, I need to get back there, you know, cause this is going way too fast. And she say, well, where do you want to go back? And I was thinking to myself, yeah, where do I want to go? Do I want to go back to my nihilism and my shitty thoughts all day long and just hoping that you know, I wouldn't suffer too much until I died. Oh, I want to go back there. Do I know? No, you don't. You want to be perfectly here, and it's good. And you're thinking through things, and that's fine. And it's been better than it ever was, and it's been so for almost a year. And it's just been like, is that bad? No, it's not. So what are you afraid of? I don't know. It's a pride thing. It's like you're not supposed to be that way. You're supposed to be different. Okay. Fine. Well, I've lost already.
I remember when I fell in love with my wife, and you know, it was, you know, you're trying to manage it. So I remember at one point I just said to her, I mean, what do we have and what do you want? I mean, it was like that point in It's a Wonderful Life when George Bailey realizes that he's, you know, he wants to go, he's got a plan, he's going to go out in life, he's going to travel, he's going to do all this stuff, but there's the savings and loan, and there's this hometown girl, and you know, and it's like, you don't organize life. In a sense, Western civilization has been set up to maintain the illusion that you can control your life and deliver the outcomes you want. It's an illusion. And it's an illusion that's dispelled by cancer, by mental illness, by recessions, by car accidents, by death, by birth, by falling in love, by all kinds of things. So, no, you're just seeing more clearly.
That's a very good, I think, yeah, that seems a very good description. It's like, okay, there's all this stuff here.
Yeah.
And I never saw that all that stuff was there. And there's all these books I'm reading. And I'm going through one of those courses on Audible. You're doing a one about philosophy and religion in the West. And I'm going through one about values through history. And it takes Hume and Aristotle. And even you quote C.S. Lewis in the first chapter. Like, why is Lewis in my philosophy course? Fine. I get it.
Get out, Clive. No more of you.
Yeah, I'm trying to get stay up. Yeah, no, yeah. So the list of stuff to discuss with Paul keeps changing. Fine, well, so maybe we've got
another great C.S. Lewis quote: "If you want to stay an atheist, you'd better be real careful about what you read." Hey, that's his quote because he lived it. He read everything. He was voracious. He read everything from the ancient world. Nearly everything from the ancient classical period in its original language. And he remembered it all. He used to play a game with the people. Kids would, you know, so kids, students would come to his office. He was a tutor. And, you know, he'd play games with them. And he'd turn his back and they'd pull a book off his shelf and they'd read something to him. And he would tell them what book, what page, what's the context, what's the meaning. I can't do that. It was that kind of mind. And yeah. So he said, if you want to stay in your nice little atheist world, imagining that, yeah, but you better not do any reading. Just stick with, and you better stick to a certain part of Netflix.
My preacher advised the series AD, Kingdom and Empire, and it's about Acts. It was good. Seriously, I mean, like a year ago, I wouldn't even have, like, I'm not going to watch it, sort of religious series. I don't know, how long do we have? We
started a bit late. Got another 15 minutes, then I got someone on the 30.
I got this big a list I still need to work through.
Well, we'll talk again.
Yeah. There's a couple of things I wanted to read. I'm interested in the idea of ethics and machine ethics and how, because AI is starting to be more and more of a subject, and I'm interested in assistive technology, intelligent care robots. So I bought this book. It's called Robot Ethics, and it's a bunch of papers and essays on the subject. And one of them is Compassionate AI and Selfless Robots, a Buddhist Approach. It's really good. But one of the chapters I found was, it's all about all these types of beings. 5.3, would it be ethical to create a suffering being? And one of the classical ethical questions that arise out of Buddhist metaphysics is whether it is ethical to have children, since life is intrinsically unsatisfactory. On the one hand, unlike most religions, Buddhism does not argue for an obligation to have children and upholds a childless life of the renunciate as the most praiseworthy. Just as contemporary social sciences found that having children generally makes adults less happy, Buddhism views the life of the householder
when
as burdensome.
When the kids are at home.
Yeah. But this goes on, but then they say, the creation of machine minds puts humans in the ethical position of being the parents of machine children. Metzinger has argued that it would be unethical to create an artificial mind until we are certain that we will create a being that is not permanently trapped in suffering, ignorance, or bliss, or some other undesirable mental state. In other words, Metzinger argues that it would be unethical to create self-aware beings who did not possess something similar to the human capacity for learning and growth. And it goes on, but I'm thinking about this like, uh-oh, I see where this is going. This is creation, and this is responsible creation, and how do you create something that has free will? And of course, these aren't new questions. When I'm reading about them in the, like, we don't even know what consciousness is, and we expect to create something like that. Here's another book, The Machine Question by David Gunkel. It's a critical perspective. First chapter, it's like Derrida and Zizek, and like, wait a second. But it's about what's being? Should a machine have logos? What is personhood? animal rights, Singer comes back into it. And I'm reading these books and it's just, I've never thought about these things. And religion doesn't seem so stupid now, does it? That's what pops up in my head. Like, you thought you were so smart, didn't you? Like, I didn't know a damn thing. So, okay, I've fallen down my mountain. I know there's an abyss down there. There's a nice little path here that seems safe. I keep falling down the mountain if I keep climbing. So, I don't know. And then climbing up the mountain and exposing yourself to new information. That sacrifice, that's risk, that's potential pain, that's rolling down, that's having your existing thoughts reanalyzed. I don't know. It's just, it's fun, but it's crazy. Oh, and I went to see Jordan Peterson.
Oh!
That was all right. That was in Amsterdam. There was only one picketer. The weather was really bad.
I want to shake the hand of that one picketer. It's like, you go, you know, you just, nobody but you, you were your side.
No, they handed out pre-printed flyers. So Dave Rubin was like, look, these Dutch people, they are really organized. Look at this nice 10-point flyer. So they, you know, they put in effort. They took responsibility. That's good. And I got to say, the evening, it was just lots of couples, lots of young folk, old folk. Right behind me were a famous comedian and a famous author. Like, I got one of his books on my shelf. Like, whoa, these people are here. And, well, Ruben was just making jokes about Amsterdam and about not remembering anything from the times he was there before. But Peterson was just, he talked about meaning and raising a child and how to teach a child and how to improve, and that improvement is suffering and pain. And he was making lots of jokes, but he was also serious. But at some point, he was having such a good mood. And I was just, everyone was having fun, everyone was enjoying it, nothing but smiles. It was really nice to be there. I mean, you've heard it all before. Like, yeah, it's just Peterson, but he was having a really good time, and that was nice to see, because, you know, you see the interviews he has to deal with, and he's tired off, and I'm glad he enjoyed Amsterdam.
Good.
Yeah. There's a book I want to read. Sorry, I'm just on a roll, and I have
keep
10
going,
minutes.
Keep going.
There's a book by Anne Forst that you might want to read, and it is God in the Machine. God in the Machine, What Robots Teach Us About Humanity and God, A Provocative Look at the Theological Implications of Artificial Intelligence and What It Says About Our Humanity. And all this stuff here. Huh. And I go, I don't have time to read Heidegger. So, yeah.
Oh, good. Cheat.
Did you get...
Go ahead, keep talking. I'm just ordering it.
Did you get a chance to...
I won't have time to read it, but it'll sit on my pile of unread books. And at one point it'll be, oh, I got to read something about this. Oh, here it is. And then I'll read it. That's how it goes.
Oh, yeah. I have this nice big pile. It's the endless pile of stuff I need to read. That's a good thing to have.
That is.
It's a sign of a busy mind, I guess.
And an unorganized life, I suppose. Although the books the stuff you held up, that was interesting too. That's the problem. Everything's just so darn interesting.
I know. If you're going to read any of these, the machine question is absolutely amazing. You would love that, the sort of philosophy that's in there. It's about moral agency, moral patience. What makes something moral? And it's just way too difficult. And then you realize, oh yeah, people have thought about this before. They just wrote it down differently. That doesn't mean that I can't just use humanism for that, but that doesn't seem to be the entire thing. I don't know. I haven't figured all this out yet. There's too much information. That's the thing. There's way too much information. So it was really weird to see Geen Stijl. It's like, Geen Stijl on my Paul van der Klee. What's this? And that's kind of that site. I mean,
yo, tell me more about that site. Talk to me a little bit about it, but
I don't know if I can just go talk about Geen Stijl, man. They're kind of a shock blog, provocative.
Yeah, that was my sense.
Yeah. But they have a history of poking at stuff that people don't like people to be poked at. Like, you shouldn't bring that up. So they're kind of a trickster, as Peterson would say. They're a trickster blog because they're a bit of the underbelly, but they also poke at stuff. But they eventually were bought by a kind of a right-wing media group, conservative media group. And they changed. I hardly visit the website, but I think they are not really what they used to be. They used to be like this small independent blog, and we're going to, you know, overthrow the order and create some chaos and reanalyze things. So they need to be there. But it was really interesting to see, because I just look at this video like, is that a Geen Stijl flag? What the? But that was a really good video about Gladiator and archetypes and your analysis of it. It's just, this stuff goes everywhere, and yeah, it's been really weird three quarters. But like, yeah, I'm still doing way better than I ever did. So
that's good. That's good.
It's really nice not to be depressed. Yeah, you probably knew that, but it really is nice.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not nice to be depressed.
And it's, I never realized how bad that was and how I saw it as the normal until I realized that, oh, this is also a state of being that exists. Oh, and now there's just all this stuff I get to do. And, okay, so if church helps with this, why not go? If going to a Bible club helps with this, why not do that? If reading religious books helps, like, what are you so afraid of? It's not hurting you. That's the continuous thing. What's the problem here? It's all pride. That's the one thing. It's like, you don't want to be seen as a Christian. Yeah, because I'm not a Christian. No, you sure? Yeah, because I don't accept Jesus. I think. Pretty sure I don't. I mean, I know we only have 7 minutes. Okay, 7 minutes. I'm going to take this full 7 minutes. I mean, how do you, no, seriously, Paul, how do you get to Jesus? How does that work? How do you integrate that? Because my preacher said, you're not going to get there rationally. Stop trying. You're going to come into another door.
Okay. So read the Gospels and look at how people get to Jesus. So Nicodemus comes. Gospel of John chapter 3, Nicodemus comes in the middle of the night, and he hasn't bought this whole thing, but so he comes at night so nobody else sees him, and he's got questions for him. There's the woman who's sick, and she's got an issue of blood, and she works her way through the crowd just to grab his garment, and Jesus says, "Who touched me?" And crazy thing. And his disciples said, "What do you mean, who touched you? We're all like this, you know?" And Jesus is like, no, someone wanted to get their hand on me. So that's why it's a weird thing, because to give the Arminians their due, and I said before, I mean, Jesus comes for you, but in a sense, in the Gospels, people sneak to grab onto him. And actually, I hope this afternoon to have some time to do a video, because I want to talk a lot about the first chapter of Mark, the Gospel of Mark, because it's this crazy scene, and I can't get it all in a 20-minute sermon, and I got to get it out of me. So I'll probably do a video this afternoon on it. But you're doing the right thing. Keep doing what you're doing. But read the Gospel. Yeah, it's terrifying. It should be. But look at Frodo, you know. Gandalf comes to Frodo's house, and Frodo's like, or Bilbo. Bilbo's like, "I don't want any stinking adventures." And then the dwarves come. It's like, freaking dwarves. And then here, we're going to take you with us as a thief. I'm not a burglar. He wakes up the next morning, and he runs. Well, why does Bilbo run to catch Gandalf and the dwarves? Well, what do you want to do? Live in your stinking house your whole freaking life and never fight trolls and be hungry and have adventures?
Yeah, I don't know, man. I mean, it seems way too nice out here. And yeah, it's really weird to have all this now. Yeah. My brother asked me, my older brother asked me, so yeah, you're starting to become a church person. Like, damn it. Like, yeah, let's not talk about that. He's like, oh, what would Dawkins say? Like, I don't know. All right. I get it. Yeah. All right. So we're in the last 4 minutes. So I got to do my shout-outs.
Okay, do your shout-outs.
Tell John Van Dunk I said, goedenavond. Tell Freddie I said hi. I hope he's doing well.
Freddie's not been doing well. I think he's going to come out of it, but he's not been doing well. But I think he's going to come out of it.
Yeah, well, we're thinking of him.
But John Van Dunk, he might come and visit you. You never know, because he gets to the Netherlands fairly regularly, and he'll look you up. That's the kind of guy John Van Dunk is. He'll come to your door. He's like Gandalf.
Oh, I'd have a chat with him. I love his attitude. He just, yeah. That 45-minute video you guys had, it was hilarious. I was laughing my ass off. It was really good. Yeah, we only got through like half of the list.
Well, we'll talk again. Just sign up again, and we'll talk again. We shouldn't wait so long between talks. But you know, my sister died. Hopefully, if my other sister heard me say that, she'd be mortified. What do you mean? You hope I don't die? It's like, yeah, it was very rude of Lori to die. So, but I got to Massachusetts after my sister died. I looked at my other sister, said, "What Lori did to us was very rude. Don't be rude." So, hopefully, I won't have that again. But
yeah. Well, if you had that power,
I don't.
Thanks for a delightful conversation, Paul. I was like, oh, how am I going to talk for 90 minutes? But yeah, it's been fun. Talk to you again soon.
It's good to see Mallory. And yeah, we'll talk again soon. Keep doing what you're doing.
I will. Take care, Paul.
Okay. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.